This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Coming your way, two ugly truths nobody wants to hear. Your addiction to shopping and flying, it's killing nature and heating the planet. J.B. McKinnon, co-author of The 100-Mile Diet on his new book, The Day the World Stops Shopping, How Ending Consumerism Saves the Environment and Ourselves. Then UK professor and aviation advisor to governments, David Lee, with the harsh facts about aircraft emissions, what they do in the atmosphere, and the future of flying. Can we quit these deadly habits? When the World Trade Towers fell, President George Bush advised Americans what to do. Go shopping. If we don't keep filling our lives with an endless parade of stuff, we all know what happens. Anarchy and famine. But the emissions, the waste, the pollution, we are shopping the planet to death and we know it. Can we ever escape these consumer lives? So a few years ago, I interviewed a Canadian journalist, J.B. McKinnon, about his co-authored book, and that became a movement, The 100-Mile Diet, A Year of Local Eating. Now he's back with his latest book, The Day the World Stops Shopping, How Ending Consumerism Saves the Environment and Ourselves, from Vancouver, Canada. James McKinnon, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Glad to be back here.
Well, of course, the whole world needs to keep making and buying stuff. We can't stop, except for a brief moment in time, we just did. James, what did we learn from the pandemic shutdowns?
I think we learned some extraordinary things. We learned that if we stop consuming at such a high rate, we get bluer skies. We get clearer stars in the night sky. We get a very abrupt and deep drop in carbon emissions. We start to see a resurgence in the vitality of the natural world. And we also saw some really dramatic changes in ourselves. We immediately started making sure that we had contact with our family and friends. We really saw what was vitally important to us during the pandemic. We started to pursue things like creative expression and personal excellence. And it was really dramatic how quickly all of that came about.
Well, those are things you cannot buy, obviously. I wonder, though, did online shopping grow to the same level as previous in-store shopping, or does going virtual result in somewhat less consumerism?
No, I mean, really, over the whole span of the pandemic, we saw people make a turn back towards consumerism. It's what we know best, and we reinvented it for the pandemic circumstances. So we did see, in fact, an increase in the sale of goods, for example. There was a steep decline in the purchase of services because we simply couldn't access those. We replaced that, I suppose, with the consumption of goods and with the consumption of watchables. We streamed more than we have ever streamed before on online.
You know, we recently did a show about degrowth. You literally searched the world to find what a deconsumer society could look like. Why don't you give us the example that you found in Japan? And that's a country that's known for its shopping and luxury brands.
Yeah, what's happening in Japan right now is remarkable. They've really gone about 30 years without much growth to speak of. There's been brief periods of growth, but for the most part, they're economy has been in something like a steady state. I ended up going to an island called Sado Island. It's a place that not only has seen degrowth, but has seen serious depopulation. So it's lost about half of its population. And that gives you a window into what would happen if we drew down consumption by a significant degree. And what you see there is simply the reinvention of society, not its collapse, but it's reinvention. You see people turning towards more self-provisioning in their lives, often growing their own food or organizing daycare for their children, things like that, creating their own forms of entertainment. You saw a shift from big resort-style tourism to smaller-scale tourism, small-scale restaurants. To some people, it's heaven, and to some people, it's not what they're looking for. You know, they want the high excitement and the thrills of downtown Tokyo, the difference being that what's going on in Sado Island is profoundly sustainable, and what's happening in downtown Tokyo is not.
So if you had to choose maybe the top few most damaging things about this consumer economy, what would you tell people about?
Well, I would certainly say that climate change is powerfully driven by consumption. Carbon emissions track very closely with GDP, and the GDP, of course, is driven by consumerism. But, I mean, it really extends to everything. Consumerism pervades the way we eat. It pervades the effect we have on forests, on water. You name an environmental problem, and consumption is a powerful driver of that. But I would also say that some of the worst effects are upon ourselves. You know, we are driven more and more to be consumers rather than, for example, participants. As I took note in the book of the world's largest experiment in participatory culture just outside of London, England, it was really affecting to see what happens when people have an opportunity to participate in all kinds of activities in their daily lives that are beyond the earn and spend cycle, as compared to lives that are consumed by consumption.
So there are people, both in distant cultures, but right around here, looking for alternatives. And what sort of pathways can we find?
What I really concluded through this search around the globe for examples of glimpses, I suppose, of what post-consumer society might look like is that we need to build this. It's not a question of making changes so much in our personal lives. We've seen through history movements towards simpler living, towards decluttering, towards voluntary simplicity and downshifting. These things have come and gone, and it seems really difficult to have them stick and endure for very long within the framework of consumer society. What we can do is start to transform that society itself so that lower consumption is built into it. And then we get the benefits of a lower consuming society without each of us having to struggle through it as an individual choice.
We want to think that continuing disasters, and we do have them, will persuade people to wake up and change their consumer ways. But in the book, you quote retired anthropologist Richard Wilk, and he said this about consumerism: it thrives in situations of instability and contradiction, on social disruption and individual mobility as resource depletion ravages this planet. I wonder, are we going to soothe our troubles by shopping even more? Is shopping now a rebellious act?
It's a really counterintuitive idea, but materialism really kicks in when we feel like our material security is under threat. I mean, it makes a certain amount of sense. You want to have materialist values. You want to get out there and sort out how you're going to put food on the table and a roof over your head when you feel your material existence is actually threatened. You know, this points towards solutions like greater equality of opportunity in employment, greater equality in the distribution of income. These sorts of things that give more people more security are actually what can help us draw down consumption as well.
Your book took me to something that I have never understood reading the Wall Street Journal or any other financial media, and that is that there's going to be some people who are going to work hard and produce things on the other side of the world. And then here in the wealthy countries, our job is to buy things. And so 70% of our economy is consumerism. But really, that just sounds nuts. I mean, there's no God-given right for one part of the planet to work and the other part of the planet to get all the stuff. I don't see how that can continue. And I guess it's not continuing.
I agree. I mean, it's fundamentally unfair. I talked to the CEO of a manufacturing plant for clothing in Bangladesh, and I mean, he points out that, you know, it's not the Bangladeshis who are polluting their own nation or driving down wages or flooding cities through the effects of climate change. It's consumers elsewhere that are having those kinds of impacts and placing those kinds of pressures on Bangladeshi society. And it was really striking to me to talk to him and hear that perspective, because maybe we've tried to convince ourselves that at best, you know, the people who are making the products that we use aren't making the link to our direct responsibility in Western society for these social and environmental consequences, but pretty clearly they are.
I think that's growing, and we're just going to see more of that. Getting closer to home, a friend of mine, he had to divorce his wife because her whole day consisted of going from one shop to another, buying things they didn't need and building up huge bills they really couldn't pay, and divorce ended up being the way out. I wonder if we'll need a new field of counseling for deprogramming shopaholics, or if you prefer, compulsive buying disorder.
I don't know. I mean, I think what's interesting about it is that the process of learning about consumption and how deeply ingrained it is actually made me more compassionate, I suppose, towards people's shopping habits, because it's a consumer society, it's a consumer economy, and there's these very powerful forces that compel us to consume. $600 billion advertising industry. We see right now government stimulus intended to get us back to the malls and buying things and taking flights, and you know, the prices set by big businesses, the interest rates set by central banks. I mean, all of these things are designed to get us out there and spending. So, you know, it's not something where I really think there's a ton of value in making individual consumers feel terrible and guilty about doing exactly what so many powerful forces are driving them to do. I think it's really this question of starting to look at the system itself and how we can make changes in the system that will make it easier for all of us to consume less. Most people would agree that a lot of the consumption we do isn't providing much to our quality of life in the richer countries. They may feel sparks of joy, as they say, from purchasing and repurchasing and buying more and more, but it's not accumulating into deep satisfaction or enduring happiness for very many people at this point.
So you bought a $50 broom.
I did. Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things with this was realizing that being thrifty isn't always the way to consume less. I think we kind of conflate those two things, but some people are thrifty and they buy enormous numbers of goods. So I started experimenting with this idea of, you know, buying fewer but better things, better quality things. And a $50 broom was one of those. And so I bought a handmade broom made by local artisans here in Vancouver, quite a bit more than a broom I might have bought at Walmart, but imbued with all kinds of values that are important to me. You know, I was able to hand my money over to people who, you know, I can pop by their store anytime and see them. It's repairable, and they're happy to do that for me. It's high quality. It sweeps like a dream, and it's very long-lasting. So, I mean, I'll have this broom for 20 years, perhaps, or more. So I started, you know, through this process, changing my own consumption habits. I still am interested in buying things secondhand and so on, but moving to this concept of buying fewer but better things allows us to surround ourselves. If we're going to have objects surrounding ourselves, then why not let them be beautiful products that are wonderful to use?
So when people get afraid of a crash, or actually experience one personally, what are the first items cut from spending, and what do most people see as truly indispensable, which I assume is apparently toilet paper?
So toilet paper is definitely a clear winner. It's actually really difficult to say. I mean, I looked at this for the United States in the Great Recession. There's a number of things that are pretty clear. People will stop buying new cars, basically big ticket items fall away pretty quickly because people don't want to gamble that much money. But beyond a certain point, people are very idiosyncratic. I mean, we're all individuals. We have very individual ways of consuming, and what's important to one person can be utterly insignificant to another. But what I do think is maybe more interesting in things like crashes is that you do see people move towards things that help them with self-provisioning. So gardening supplies, things that they use for cooking. You do see people acquiring different products that let them get out into the great outdoors, that let them get out and get healthy with their bodies, because often during the crash, a lot of us have more time to spend doing things for ourselves. And this, of course, is one of the, you know, the great lessons of a deconsumer society, is that we do trade off goods, services, and experiences to some extent, but what we get in exchange is a lot more free time that we can invest. And what people often invest that free time in is relationships, particularly relationships with friends and family and even strangers, but also in relationships with the natural world.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. With us is journalist and author J.B. McKinnon. We are talking about his latest book, The Day the World Stopped Shopping, How Ending Consumerism Saves the Environment and Ourselves. I did not know that Finland experienced a pretty severe fall during the early 1990s. How did people adapt to that?
Finland was an unusual situation because they have a really unified culture, and they also have, you know, quite a strongly social democratic government structure. So they taxed the wealthy, they distributed wealth. Maybe more than anything else, what you saw in Finland was a certain amount of relief from the direction that things had been going. So at the time that the Great Finnish Depression struck in the 1990s, Finland had just gone through the same kind of boom as a lot of places in the West saw in the 80s. They had yuppie culture. They had the greed is good mentality starting to build in Finland. And that was historically brand new in that country. It had been a really strongly social democratic country up to that point. The 1990s saw relief from that and a return to a sense of greater equality between individual Finns. They weathered the storm without, as people pointed out, without riots, without mass protests. They buckled down, shared what they had to some extent and through the government, and they got through it.
Kind of reminds me of what people did in Iceland, too. On another topic, talk to us about the links between shopping and the night sky. I never considered this until I read your book.
Yeah, this is one of the quirkier aspects when I started looking into, well, what happens if we suddenly stop consuming so much. One of the things that came out of the research was that the world starts to get dimmer. So I had not realized that there's a fairly fixed percentage. I can't recall exactly what it is right now, but there's a fairly fixed percentage of the GDP of any nation that gets spent on lighting. So when degrowth occurs, the overall brightness of a society actually starts to dim. That can be quite beneficial. I mean, we have quite a few problems with light pollution, and of course, lights burn energy. So it raised that question, you know, would we be comfortable living in a somewhat darker world? Is that the kind of shift in consumption that we would be able to welcome? And I think the upside, of course, is that you do end up with wonderful night skies. You end up with much less light pollution. And the only real downside seems to be that we're anxious about adapting to a little bit more darkness. But there's great variety in the cities around the world in terms of how bright or how dim they are. And so I visited Berlin, which is one of the dimmer of the large cities. And I thought it was a wonderful place to visit at night. People sitting in darkened parks, dimmer streets than we see in a lot of cities around the world. Personally, I found it soothing and pleasant, and it was wonderful to be able to stand in the middle of a big city and see, you know, two or three times more stars than I do here in Vancouver.
Are you aware of the Reverend Billy Talon and the Church of Stop Shopping?
You bet I am, yeah.
Well, he's kind of a hero, but I think that in some of his actions, I mean, at one point he was standing in a mall with a bullhorn telling people to stop shopping as sort of a religious sermon, and he was arrested and taken away in handcuffs. So I started thinking about all the ways that the big system that you just described earlier will coerce us and fight off any anti-consumerism, trying to suppress it.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. I mean, it really is. Part of the reason that I started working on this book is because as a topic, consumption and consumerism had really fallen by the wayside. I mean, I really hadn't seen it at the center of discussions around sustainability since the 1990s. And that didn't make any sense to me, given that consumption is not only now the biggest driver of environmental crises, but it's getting worse all the time. You know, some of the conversations I had as I tried to reach out to larger corporations and see how they respond to the idea that maybe they should be addressing sustainability by by simply encouraging people to reduce their consumption. And some of those conversations became almost cloak and dagger. I mean, within the larger corporations of the world, they really do not want to talk about this subject. And it was a frightening topic for some people to approach, to the extent that they, you know, many people were either unwilling to talk to me or certainly not willing to talk to me on the record. But at the same time, I did find, you know, a lot of people are thinking about these things and a lot of people are recognizing the nature of this problem. We need to break it up back out into the open and put it at the center of our conversations again.
And meanwhile, the web seems to work against us. If I look at a bird bath and decide, well, I don't need a bird bath, so I'm not going to buy one of those, I get hunted for days, maybe weeks, by little pictures of bird baths everywhere I go. How can we change that? Should we be going to Facebook and to Twitter and Instagram and say, you have a part to play in the wrecking of the world. Are you going to change the rule somewhat?
These are the kinds of issues that we should be looking at, right? We should be able to opt out of these sorts of things. And if it means that we need to move towards models that are advertising free, and that means that we have to pay more for the information that we access, then, you know, that's part of the discussion. But we certainly should be able to opt out of advertising that targets us in the way you described so well. You know, these bird baths and pairs of pants and skis and things like this that pursue us through the internet, those are directly trying to overcome what is supposed to be a good consumer habit, which is you feel that impulse to buy something and you give yourself a little time to see whether or not you really, really want to buy it. That's the kind of impulse that helps us draw down consumption. And here we have big business and big tech specifically targeting that weakness and trying to break it down. So it is exactly the kind of thing that we want to look at regulating in some way.
Well, we learn a ton by looking at what would happen the day the world stopped shopping. It's hard to imagine that it will happen anytime soon. Maybe it will take decades. Maybe we need a time for withdrawal, or maybe we will have a revolution when people finally figure out what's killing the planet. What are your thoughts? How is this going to go forward?
Yeah, I mean, the day the world stops shopping is a thought experiment in my book, right? In order to sort of see how we can get past this dilemma we're in, where we need to stop shopping for the sake of the planet, and yet we seem to have to keep shopping for the sake of the economy, I wanted to try this thought experiment where we just, you know, I just on the page make stopping shop and see how it plays out over the coming days, weeks, decades, even centuries. And the way to think about it is not that we're aiming for some kind of moment when we all put our wallets away and never buy another unnecessary thing again, but rather that we start to think about a gradual change in the system towards a system that encourages more durable products and repairable products, that builds the true cost of social and environmental injuries into the prices of the products that we buy in the same manner that carbon taxes are starting to do today. We can change our cities so that there's more things that we can do in the cities that are not consumptive. We can draw down inequality, because inequality is a big driver of consumption. So I think we're looking at more of, it can start tomorrow, but it will play out over years in the same way that the green technology or the digital technology revolutions played out. We didn't expect those things to happen overnight, and a shift to a deconsumer society doesn't happen overnight either. It's work at every level and in every corner of society and culture.
I mentioned you were a journalist. I find your work all over the place. You also teach writing at the University of British Columbia. I'm interested in your process. It seems like it's a personal one. Your 100-mile diet was certainly personal. This book sounds pretty personal, the way you approached it. Is it organic? Do you know what the next thing that's going to bubble out of you will be? Are you working on something now?
I'm always working on something. I mean, at this point, I've shifted back to working on some magazine-length pieces. But I usually have a bunch of book ideas tucked away in my in my head. And when I finish one project, I kind of reach inside and look for one that I think is going to fascinate me and engage me at the level that it really has to write a book, because it's a long process putting these things together. And this one was especially gratifying, I think, because I wasn't sure that there was a lot new to say about consumption. I mean, we've had people throughout history saying we need to consume less, we need to be less materialist, you know, we need to shop less. I wasn't totally sure that there would be something new to say about it. But when I went out and really looked at, well, what might be involved in creating a lower consuming world, then I found all these interesting people and exciting case studies from history and really great stories to tell that illuminate what could be the path towards that deconsumer society.
Yes, you just got me thinking about a lot of history. There have been the Christian sects who renounced materialism and lived with less, and, of course, in Asian cultures, in the Hindu religions, we find people who are doing that, some in Buddhism. There's been a struggle to try and rearrange ourselves according to the physical world that we live in. I think your book is part of that. It's part of self-discovery in a big way.
I think so. I mean, I think what people who read this book will, I think they'll be entertained. I mean, the thought experiment was fun to do. It was fun to take the world and make the shopping stop and see what plays out. That was an enjoyable experience. But what comes out of it are these deeper themes of change at every level, from the kind of choice we make when we set out to buy a product that we need to the way we orient our values and what priorities we put at the center of our lives. And, you know, it was really fascinating encountering, for example, people in Namibia whose cultural practice for literally tens of thousands of years has been to live with very, very few possessions, and to, you know, to meet and speak with those people and get a sense of, well, and really just to observe how deeply satisfying their lives appear to be. I mean, certainly as satisfying and as rich and fulfilling as our lives, and I think in some ways more so.
And those people could have gone and gotten more and stashed it away any time and did not. And that goes against everything that's holy as a Canadian. We're always banking up stuff for the next winter and maybe for our retirement 50 years away. It's a different concept of time. And I wonder if the Namibians were more living in the present than we are able to do. We'll have to call it there. Go find The Day the World Stops Shopping, How Ending Consumerism Saves the Environment and Ourselves. We all need it more than we know. James, maybe people will buy your book and then decide to stop buying books. Then what?
Well, I mean, I guess that's a good start. But, yeah, I mean, the book is not saying, nobody should ever buy anything ever. I like to think that if people are buying fewer, better things, then I hope I've written a better book, something that's going to feel worth it for people to own and read. And, of course, there's always the library.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Are you aching to travel? To see dream destinations, relatives you miss so much, or business opportunities? How do you justify your next flight, knowing each gallon of jet fuel burn makes the coming climate even harder for all of life? What about buying carbon offsets to cover the flight? We have reached the expert with the answers. In the UK, Professor David Lee is director of the Centre for Aviation, Transport and Environment at Manchester Metropolitan University. David has researched and published atmospheric science for over three decades and on aircraft emissions since the late 1990s. David Lee, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Media and the airline industry tell us vaccinated people are bursting to get back on board. Brits want to go to Spain, Aussies and Germans want to travel all over the world, and Americans take planes everywhere for everything, of course. What is wrong with flying, David?
I guess there's nothing wrong with flying in the sense that it's one of our modern day activities that we depend on for business and leisure. But in these days of increasing climate awareness and increasing awareness of our actions on climate, I think we have to reappraise what we do, how we do it, and how frequently we do it.
Well, let's take it piece by piece. The prime problem is the climate impact of air travel, as you say, and then we will get to the schemes and calculations to offset that carbon. What is the general consensus of the global contribution of the airline industry to global warming?
That's a relatively easy question to answer because we've done some work on that recently, a group of 20-odd authors. We looked at this issue. The authors are from North America, from Europe, from all around the world, from China. And we calculated that of human impacts on climate, aviation, global aviation, represents about 3.5%.
Well, that doesn't sound by much, but when you add up all the various wedges, it's a big one, and it's something we can do something about. Now, I was a little surprised to read this in your published paper in 2021, quote, "Contrail cirrus, consisting of linear contrails and the cirrus cloudiness arising from them, yields the largest positive net warming term, followed by CO2 and NOx emissions," end of quote. So changes to the clouds are actually a greater warming than carbon dioxide from burned jet fuel?
Currently, yes. It all depends how you look at things. At the moment, the way we measure this is a metric called radiative forcing of climate. So it's the simplest way of looking at things. But it's a backward-looking thing. It's a historical thing and tells you where you are right now as a result of history. So the balance between CO2 as a long-lived greenhouse gas and the short-lived effects, like a change in cloudiness, that balance can change. It's not a fixed amount. But at the moment, we think the largest fraction of the warming is coming from contrail cirrus, which is enhanced cloudiness through linear contrails from aircraft, which can then spread out and form an extensive cloud cover. That has a net warming effect. But at the moment, yes, it's larger than the historical CO2 signal, but that can change. If, for example, if we didn't increase our rate of flying and we just had a kind of flat line of emissions, because CO2 accumulates in the atmosphere, the contrail cirrus effect would stabilize very quickly and it would flatline as an effect. But because CO2 accumulates in the atmosphere, that would become bigger and bigger, even for a constant emission rate. So that little kind of conceptual demonstration of how that ratio is quite sensitive and can change depending on our patterns of travel.
Well, it does surprise me because carbon dioxide can last for thousands, tens of thousands of years in the atmosphere, whereas the clouds, I mean, they come and they go, and if we stop flying, I guess that impact would stop, wouldn't it?
That's correct. Yes, that's absolutely correct. Because carbon dioxide has, it strictly speaking, has multiple lifetimes because it gets taken up by different parts of the Earth atmosphere system. So that is around for a very long time. So a fraction of any CO2 emission, about 20%, is effectively up in the atmosphere. You could say forever. It's millennia because that's the kind of fossilization removal time scale. So the problem is anything to do with CO2, if you have an emission of CO2, the effect is extremely long lasting. So if hypothetically we stopped flying, that effect from contrail cirrus would go away very, very quickly. But the effect from the CO2 emissions that we've emitted historically, that the effect from them just keeps going and going and going. So that's why it's so problematic on the CO2 side.
David, it might amuse you to know that just talking about contrails has probably triggered in some of our listeners and in others a real interest, because we had to do a whole program with experts to say that no, contrails were not a plot by the powers that be to modify the climate and to cool the earth. They're actually just
something that happens when you fly planes around in certain circumstances. Your thoughts?
Yes, that's right. Unfortunately, it was a great game for the conspiracy theorists to talk about contrail cirrus for some time. I remember the first time I came across this in the late 1990s in the US at an academic conference, and we all the scientists around the room looked at each other and laughed, you know, because there was a conspiracy theory going around that somehow the government was spraying us all and trying to either affect our health or affect our fertility or some obscure thing like that. Unfortunately, that conspiracy theory hasn't completely gone away, but of course it's complete rubbish.
Well, how much does it matter that this combustion happens high in the atmosphere, and could we reduce the impacts by flying higher or lower?
Yeah, that's one of the interesting questions that we have looked at as a science community a little bit. In terms of the CO2, because it's so well mixed in the atmosphere, obviously because it lasts for a very long time, hundreds to thousands of years, the vast part of it, it's very well mixed. So it doesn't matter whether you emit CO2 at the surface or at the top of the atmosphere. It has the same effect, ultimately. The NOx emissions, you get NOx, that's nitrogen oxides, when you combust fossil fuel in air. And it's a combination of the oxygen and the nitrogen. It's just a high combustion temperature product. That matters where you do it, because the top of the atmosphere for ozone production, which you get from NOx emissions, it triggers a whole set of atmospheric chemistry reactions. And those chemistry reactions can result in both warming and cooling effects, but the net effect is warming from aircraft NOx. But the effect of NOx at the top of the atmosphere, where aircraft cruise for around 10 to 12 kilometers or, you know, 30-odd thousand feet, that tends to have a stronger warming effect overall, because the ozone produced per molecule NOx is higher. The actual physical mechanism, the physics behind how climate change happens on a short-lived climate gas like ozone, varies by the height of the atmosphere. It's almost at its peak forcing warming rate at those cruise altitudes. And the chemistry up there is... Perversely, it's relatively clean, but that means we get very fast production rates of ozone. So it's a warming effect that does happen up there. And there's a kind of an analogous thing for contrails and contrail cirrus. Normally, if you introduce clouds into the atmosphere, effectively what you're doing is you're introducing a white surface. So in the scheme of things, you have solar radiation. It finds a white surface and it's reflected back to space. So that's automatically a cooling effect. However, that again depends on the height of the atmosphere. So clouds generated at low levels generally have a slight cooling effect. Whereas clouds at the top of the atmosphere, where aircraft cruise, we get this contrail formation and they spread into linear structures and then, you know, sort of hazy structures of contrail cirrus. Yes, that presents a white surface to space, and it reflects solar radiation back to space during the day. But at night, when there's no sunshine to reflect back to space, they have the effect of trapping infrared radiation, which comes from the ground, because, you know, as solar radiation comes in, it hits the ground, and we get infrared radiation. It's at a different wavelength, comes off, and that's what heats the atmosphere. But these clouds at such high levels tend to trap that, particularly at night. So yes, there is a kind of height effect built in with some of these effects to do with aviation.
I don't want to get too deep into the atmospheric chemistry, but can you just note that somewhere in this mix, even methane is affected by airline emissions?
Yes, that's right. It's part of the so-called net NOx effect, because there are a number of effects that happen. So the short-term thing that happens quite quickly on the timescales of, you know, hours, is we get chemical reactions that turn NOx into a molecule called ozone. So that's three oxygen atoms. And at that height in the atmosphere, ozone is kind of not really that good for us. In the stratosphere, of course, it protects us from ultraviolet radiation, very harmful ultraviolet radiation, which otherwise we'd fry without it. That's the stratospheric ozone depletion problem. But lower down in the atmosphere, it acts as a climate warming gas, and it's not really doing that much for us in terms of the UV protection. That all happens in the stratosphere. So you get this formation of ozone, but also there's a molecule produced in all these complex chemical reactions called hydroxyl radical. And what that does is it destroys some of the ambient methane. So aircraft themselves don't emit methane, but some of the gases that aircraft produce in the exhaust, those reactions destroy ambient methane. So if you get a reduction of ambient methane, you can account for that as a cooling effect, if you like. But that cooling effect is smaller than the warming effect at the moment. Although, again, that ratio is not a fixed thing. It depends on what's going on with the chemistry. The chemistry is very, very non-linear, so things don't scale automatically in the way you might think they do. So, you know, twice the emissions doesn't mean twice the effect, and that kind of thing. So yes, methane chemistry in the atmosphere is involved as well.
So, David Lee, the airline industry says they've created more and more efficient engines that burn less and less fuel. And at the same time, statistics of the number of planes up there and miles traveled keep going up and up. Can efficiency win the race?
That's the problem. We basically are consuming, if you like. You know, the growth rate of aviation is faster than the reduction rate that technology is producing. I mean, by no doubt at all, aircraft engines are highly efficient, very, very complicated, and, you know, they represent a kind of pinnacle in technological development. They're really, really fantastic feats of engineering. They're very, very fuel efficient. But the trouble is the rate at which we can improve the technology is a little bit slow, because if you consider the average lifetime of an aircraft, the main carrier, you know, the main carriers like, say, for example, Air Canada or, you know, Air France, British Airways, whatever, United, they tend to keep their aircraft for around 10 years. But after those 10 years, it's generally sold on to smaller carriers. So on average, an aircraft has a lifetime of about 30 years. So if you imagine how quickly you change your car, you know, that the general public, the fleet turnover, we call it, is quite quick for ground transportation. But for air transportation, the fleet turnover time is quite slow. So that entry into service of new technology, which does indeed improve things, is slow. And we have this inherent consumption statistic of how much we want to fly is outpacing this technological improvement all the time. That's at the core of the problem. And as you alluded to earlier, you know, it's not a huge amount of the global warming signal at the moment, but the trouble is it's an industry that's very locked into liquid fossil fuels at the moment, and we have a public that wants to fly all the time. So it's a behavioral thing that's hard to change as well. So whilst everything needs to come down quite dramatically if we're going to hit, you know, no more than 1.5 degrees warming, all other industries are trying their best to, you know, bring things down through different technologies and different ways of doing things. Aviation doesn't really have so much choice. There's not much in the bottom drawer, if you like, to look at without changing things quite radically, such as, you know, going to things like hydrogen fuel or doing things like getting the liquid kerosene fuel from different sources and addressing the carbon emissions that way.
Tracking the climate challenge, Radio EcoShock at ecoshock.org.
You are listening to the Radio EcoShock show. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, atmospheric scientist Professor David Lee, and we are talking about the real costs of flying. Right. David, let's get on to the offsets. We can buy them. We can find them in various places. There are agents and companies selling us carbon offsets, but we don't know how good they are, and so that's partly why I'm calling you. What is the purported plan behind carbon offsets?
I tend to have a very negative view of carbon offsets because a lot of them that are being sold out there, I think, are being sold on a missold basis because the language used around them, and you only have to go onto any offsetting site to look for this, and you'll commonly find the language neutralize, so how you might neutralize your emissions. And that just simply isn't true, because the reasonable and dictionary understanding of neutralize is to make null, to make void your action. So you do one thing and you have a consequence, but you do another thing, which means it never happened. And that's the concept being sold behind offsets. The major problem with offsets is the type of offsets that are often sold. For example, the International Civil Aviation Organization offsetting scheme, which is global, and it's a good initiative in the sense that aviation is trying to address its emissions, but I don't think this is the right way, because most of those offsets being sold to you are avoidance. So putting it very crudely, it represents something like a guy stood there with a match burning saying, well, I was going to set fire to this forest, but if you pay me, I won't do it. So the emission that you're offsetting never actually happened, but you pay the guy, the fictional guy, not to blow the match out, and the transaction is complete, and you then go on to emit your fossil fuel. So how is that reducing an emission? It's not. The simple arithmetic behind it doesn't work. You have two intended units of emission. I intend to set fire to this forest, and I won't. You know, that's an avoidance. And you have, I intend to get on a plane and emit a unit of CO2. So it was two intended minus one, which still leaves you one. So that emission from the fossil fuel still happened. So, you know, I think, personally, it's quite a reprehensible business. You know, it's not the way forward because it's not actually solving problems. It does have other more social advantages like, you know, habitat protection and things like that. But in the strict sense of does it reduce emissions, no, it doesn't. The atmosphere does not lie. You know, if you put CO2 up there from fossil fuel combustion, you will get an increase in the measurements of CO2.
I know. One of my favorite stories, and I mentioned this to you in email, is of the Canadian promoter Russ George, who managed to convince the Vatican that they would be the first country to be carbon neutral because he would plant a forest in Hungary that would absorb as much carbon as they were putting out, which I severely doubt it ever would, but that was his plan. Well, the forest never got planted, but they made a big promotion about it, and the public thought that it actually happened, but nothing actually happened. Now, one of my listeners was asked to help a company calculate their carbon offsets for airline flights, and he found widely different calculations about how much CO2 equivalence was required considering the high altitude jet emissions compared to ground emissions, and there were multipliers of 1.5 all the way up to 3 times for aircraft. What do you make of all that?
That's a very tricky business. It's an aspect that originates in the science, and it originates with all these things and concepts we were talking about earlier about, you know, things having stronger effects than CO2 per unit of fuel burnt, that kind of thing. And it comes from two different directions. Basically, the non-governmental organization lobbyists, environmentalists, like to use these kind of what we call metrics, these emission equivalent metrics, to bump up the signal and say, ah, yes, but, you know, it's for every unit of CO2 you emit, it's roughly, you know, say, for example, equivalent to 3 units of CO2, and therefore you ought to pay more attention to it. And I understand and sympathize with that argument. The precise number really depends on how you calculate it. There are different ways of calculating this emission multiplier, and they vary according to your methodology, and there are a number of different methodologies, all robust, all scientifically correct. But one of the critical things is because CO2 is so long-lasting, you have to calculate these emission equivalences over a certain time period. We call it a time horizon. And the answer you get for these emission multipliers depends on the equivalence metric you use. Just to give you examples of that, there's one called the global warming potential. There's another one called the global temperature change potential. And you have to calculate these over different periods. All the numbers are scientifically correct. None of them are wrong, but what they highlight is that there's an element of choice. It's kind of, well, what metric suits you? Does a temperature metric suit your temperature-based target? You know, does a GWP, your global warming potential, are you calculating that to calculate an energy balance, which it's more suited to? And these are highly technical questions, but they get picked up by these kind of multipliers. And then I think they're useful numbers to illustrate the size of the effect, if you like, that currently, you know, aviation may have an effect that's something like 2 to 3 times its implied CO2 emission. Now, I think that is a useful concept. It's accurately describing an effect. But if you start turning that into a monetary value, I have misgivings about that, particularly when it comes to offsetting, of course. So the simple message is there are a number of numbers out there in terms of a multiplier number. Some of them are scientifically wrong. People pick up the wrong method. Some of them are right, but what they don't tell you is that they're highly variable. You know, you could have a number that's 1.1, or you could have a number that's around 3 or 4. It just really depends. And I think by not giving people the range like we do in science, I think it's a bit disingenuous. In terms of calculating things for offsets, well, we've talked about offsets, though, you know, my misgivings about offsets aside, I think in terms of carbon calculators for people's flights, if they want to know how much they're emitting, I don't really like these multipliers. I don't think they're useful for that kind of thing. I think they're a useful communication tool.
For me, one of the big problems is that it's a bad social deal. I mean, I know some forest activists who say, well, yes, we're getting some money from the carbon offset people. We're sending in experts. We might save some endangered species. We might buy some forest land that would otherwise be logged. But we should be doing those things anyway just to save the climate. And we can't do it just as some sort of tax on the airline industry so that, you know, I mean, would we accept the money if it came, say, from prostitution or child labor? Well, no, we wouldn't. And this is another damaging industry, in my opinion. And to take that money and say, well, we're doing some good with a little teeny dribble of a fraction of it, it doesn't wash for me.
I have a sympathy for that point of view. I mean, the way I liken offsets, I mean, I think the public generally, they want to do the right thing if they're able to. And if they think, if somebody tells them that you can so-called neutralize your emissions through offsets, and their avoidance of sex, you know, it's difficult for the public to understand all these complex topics about carbon cycle and whether things are actually changing or not. Most of the time, they're volunteering to pay this levy when it's not really doing anything. And I think that's not really on. I would liken it to a Lutheran indulgence.
Your work has helped advise the UK government and the EU, I think, and those host some of the world's largest airline industries, plus aircraft manufacturing, of course. How are those governments doing in approaching aircraft and warming, in your opinion?
Here you get into tricky aspects of policy, because it depends on something that might feel rather arbitrary in the sense of whether a flight is domestic or international. If a flight is domestic, say within, you know, within Canada or within the UK or within the United States, you know, say for example, New York to Denver, that's a domestic flight. Now, the carbon emissions associated with that come under the national policy and their national targets and their so-called nationally determined contributions, which is, you know, how much they say they will reduce emissions by. You know, a country doesn't need to prescribe they're going to do anything to a particular industry. They just need to meet their targets somehow, and that gives them the greatest flexibility. The problem is that of total aviation, the largest proportion of it, about 65%, is actually international travel. So everything in terms of international aviation falls to the UN agency, the International Civil Aviation Organization. So there is this complex situation where things at the international level, which is 65% of global aviation, are dealt with by ICAO, and, you know, domestic aviation is dealt in some way under national targets. So governments across the world do have this kind of complex policy situation to navigate through. And again, you know, I've worked in this area on policy advice as a scientist for many years, and I appreciate how difficult it is to navigate this thing. I mean, I think people are doing better. Some countries are starting to declare international emissions within their own national targets, so they're kind of embracing more emissions than they need to and saying that they will do something about them. There's a massively growing awareness about aviation emissions because, as we outlined before, if you like, the problem is not now. The problem is in 10 to 20, 30 years' time when everything is coming down to hopefully net zero through different and faster technology developments which are more radical. Aviation is still kind of stuck with the kind of tube and wing concept running on liquid fuel. You know, it's very, very hard to have a paradigm shift away from that. I think things are going well. There are ways and means of fixing things. What it will do is it will make air travel more expensive. I think that's one of the simple conclusions. And you could argue it will make it appropriately expensive.
The pandemic has caused a significant drop in air travel, but now people are talking like they'd really like to get going again. Is there any safe way for the climate to fly? Is it okay, or do we just have to give it up for a while?
There is a very good way forward. It's quite complicated. We basically, if we're stuck, as I said, with the liquid fossil fuels at the moment, and we're stuck with liquid fuels for our aircraft for, you know, the foreseeable future. If we can manufacture those fuels either from synthetic fuels, you actually manufacture the fuels rather than, you know, refine oil, or you produce them from biofuel and you carefully account for all the carbon life cycle analysis and you produce low carbon footprint fuels, that is the most safe and secure way of doing it. The problem I think that is associated with all that is we know how to do that. So on synthetic fuels, we know how to make synthetic fuels, but we don't know how to make them at scale and at a reasonable cost. And as I say, it will put the price of flying up. I think the missing piece in the jigsaw puzzle to fix this and fix it via the fuels is actually the policy in the background that says no more fossil fuels. That's what we need. We need a phase out. We need a declared phase out of fossil fuel usage.
From Manchester Metropolitan University, we've been speaking with Professor David Lee. You can find links to some of David's papers on climate and aviation in my show blog at ecoshock.org. David, thank you for sharing your expertise with us.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
The pandemic is not over, but neither is hope. As South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu said, "I am not an optimist. I am a prisoner of hope." Thank you for hearing Unwanted Truths, or as alternative radio used to call it, Unwelcome Guests. I'm Alex Smith. Be kind to yourself.